Hey, I'm Kirk Harnack. On This Week in Radio Tech, Chris Tarr and I tackle the tough issues of the day, including Friday Night Calculus, dead birds, and strobe lights. On This Week in Radio Tech, coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 133, recorded June 13th, 2012. Friday night is for calculus. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Axia Audio and the new Radius IP Audio Console. On the web at axiaaudio.com. Hey, and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and we are going to have a great time. Me and Chris Tarr talking about radio engineering stuff. And we're glad that you're along, too. Hey, you can join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. If you're watching live, you're probably tuned in to live.twit.tv or just to the regular twit.tv website and click on the live button. You can also enjoy this show after the fact on the website twit.tv/twit, and you can subscribe to it on iTunes. So all different kinds of ways to get this show. So again, welcome in. This is show number 133, brought to you by Axia. I'm Kirk Harnack, and along with me, I want to welcome in from Muckwonago, Wisconsin, my steady cohort and co-host. It's Chris Tarr. Hey, Chris.
Hello there. I would like to assure, by the way, J.P. Clark in the chat room that I will not be dropping trow this evening. So you do not have that to look forward to. I'm sorry.
Oh, man.
But well, that's something I could only get away with once. Now, you know, Burke is over there with a button, and as soon as I start to move to get up, the video goes blank. It's kind of like, you know, in Howard Stern Private Parts where there was the manager at his desk. With the dump button waiting for him to say something. And, so that's Burke's job now, is to babysit me. Anyway, I am the Geek Jedi. I write for Radio Guide Magazine. I'm also Director of Engineering for Intercom in Milwaukee and Madison. And I co-founded the website The Virtual Engineer.
The Virtual Engineer?
That's the name of the site. The web address is broadcastengineering.info.
That's what I thought. Broadcastengineering.info. Very good site. And good chat discussions go on there. If you need some help, need some information on something, great place to go. Great place to go.
Absolutely.
Hey, Chris, we're going to, as the show moves along, you've got some progress reports on your station build out. And I want to hear about that. Some of your thoughts on, you know, destroying property and tearing things up. We've got a few topical things to talk about, too. Not that that's not topical, but a few things are in the news. And we're just going to throw these things around. The chat room is welcome to participate. If you got thoughts on this stuff, please throw your thoughts in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. There's a term that's been thrown around in broadcasting, FM broadcasting circles especially, and that it's an interesting term. It's Franken FM. Franken.
Nice.
Now, it's not Al Franken. It's Frankenstein FM. And what this is, well, Chris, you know about this. Tell us about Franken FMs. What does that mean?
Well, essentially what these stations are TV translators, rather, on Channel 6. And the Channel 6 audio on TV translators is 87.75 megahertz, which a lot of new radios are able to tune down as far. So what one company in particular has been doing is putting on these low-power analog Channel 6 low-power TV transmitters in large markets, and essentially just throwing up random pictures on the video and using the audio as essentially a radio station. And in fact, in the Chicago market, I know for certain, even has PPM for Arbitron on there and gets rated. So you're seeing a lot of these kind of a backdoor into getting an FM into a major market. However, there is a caveat, and that is there's a sunset date on the analog FM TV transmitters. So when that sunset date happens, these disappear. But it's kind of interesting and actually kind of controversial how these things are running, because it's kind of a backdoor into putting a TV radio station on.
You know, I'm looking at this article in RadioWorld.com. They have an article dated just today, actually, and the headline is "A New Franken FM Preps for Cleveland Launch." A new Franken FM is going to go on the air in Ohio. Venture Technologies is testing the frequency of 87.7. And as you said, it's actually 87.75. But digital FM radios, you punch 87.7 and it'll pretty well tune it right in. It'll capture the PLL. The company has other stations operating on the analog carrier of a TV channel 6. The radio industry veterans are, you know, call these Franken FMs. As you said, there is a sunset date on these. They're going to sunset in the year 2015. So this is 2012. At the most, these are going to be on the air for three more years. I got to wonder, would you start a venture that you knew had to shut its doors, at least in the way that you're opening it, in 3 years?
Well, I think you look at it as you know, the cost to get into this probably isn't too expensive. So depending on how you do it, for example, the one that they own here in Chicago is being leased by Randy Michael's company, Merlin Media. So mm-hmm. I'm sure they're making some pretty good bucks just for owning that license. And that was an interesting one. It didn't take them long to get the Chicago one on. It's actually licensed to Rochelle, Illinois, which mm-hmm. is a suburb about 60 miles out. It's hard to say. I mean, you know, if you can get into it fairly inexpensively, at least in the large markets, somebody's going to want to put something on there, even in the short term. And you could probably, you know, pretty good little quick investment.
Now, I understand that people who own regular FM radio channels, licensees of regular FM radio channels, are not exactly thrilled about Franken FMs and the fact that people get a Channel 6, maybe a low power Channel 6 license, and make it into a radio station.
Well, I mean, first of all, yeah, they're all low power TV. It's the only thing allowed left to do analog. And, you know, obviously not violating the letter of the FCC, but it is violating the spirit of the regulation there. You know, for example, you're using audio bandwidth much greater than what normal TV stations use. Also, you put a stereo pilot in there and you know, you're essentially doing FM composite baseband, which is not typically what you would do on television. So, you know, on the other hand, because the FCC never specified that you couldn't do it, it's allowed. Yeah. So essentially, it's kind of a loophole. And, you know, the companies that spent millions and millions of dollars to get into these large markets are obviously not real happy that somebody's been able to find a loophole and drop something in like that.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, if you, is this something that you would do if you wanted to have a major market?
You know, I would for a client. I mean, that's what they pay me for, you know, is to figure these sorts of things out. I think it's very creative. And yeah, okay. It's kind of, you know, I probably wouldn't be the most popular guy on the block, but you know, if you know, just like this company, I'm sure has an engineer at some point along the line went, hey, you know, you could do this.
There's rules about commercial operation on low power FMs, but those aren't the rules that apply to low power TV.
Correct. Well, that's what's so interesting about it is there's nothing. I mean, this is essentially the equivalent of a, in some cases, coverage wise, in some of these markets, a Class B FM out of nowhere. Now, obviously, it's a little difficult marketing-wise. I mean, a lot of people don't know that there's anything on that end of the dial. I mean, you're way at the end. Yeah. Not all radios can get it either. So there's a little bit of an issue there. But the Chicago one, for example, when it was doing smooth jazz, was middle of the pack in the ratings. It didn't do too bad.
Really? Really? Yeah. Wow. Wow. Well, hey, shift gears. Last week, we talked about WWV, and Tom Ray gave us a tour of the WWV transmitter site and WWVB out in Fort Collins, Colorado. We had a good time also with, you know, WWV, the big market thing. WWV, Fort Collins, Denver. Just came across the wires today from RadioWorld.com in that WWVB, now that's the 60 kilohertz transmission. So this is really, really low frequency. And this is what most of those, you know, atomic clocks that if you buy a radio controlled WWV clock at the store, and that's what these are tuned to, the 60 kilohertz signal. It hugs the ground real well, travels a long ways, but the reception isn't always really good. And there's a report out that WWVB is trying to improve their signal penetration by adding another kind of modulation to the mix. Normally, this station transmits with amplitude modulation, but they're adding phase modulation. That's not quite frequency modulation, but it's phase modulation. They're adding this to the mix, and they're saying that they can typically get a 14 decibel better signal-to-noise ratio into a receiver that's designed to pick up a signal with phase modulation. Chris, is that making sense to you, that it's easier for a receiver to detect a change in phase, even if a change in amplitude is not so detectable because of noise?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, you don't get a lot of atmospheric noise that has a phase component to it. So if you know what you're listening for, it's a lot easier to pick that up out of the noise than, say, for example, it's the same kind of situation with digital radio, any kind of digital radio versus analog. You know, you don't necessarily in the digital world have to shout louder than anybody else. You just have to shout differently.
Gotcha. And you know, that's why, well, that's part of what makes FM reception, and this was, of course, big news back when FM came along. FM reception is basically noise-free compared to AM reception. And you mentioned atmospheric noises, all kinds of things in the world, in the atmosphere, in the environment that will cause an amplitude modulation receiver to pick that up as noise. That's why you hear, you know, lightning strokes on an AM receiver. But you don't hear them, at least not very often, on an FM receiver, because the FM receiver is listening for changes in the frequency. And a phase modulated or a PM receiver, phase modulation receiver, is looking for changes in the phase. Chris, one thing I've never been real clear on is there much of a difference between phase modulation and frequency modulation in terms of, you know, modeling it in my head, what's going on here?
No, I, and again, I'm not 100% into that. It's not something I run into every day. But if I remember correctly, it's similar in I'm trying to think of a good way to say this. It's similar in how it looks, for example, as opposed to like amplitude modulation is very simple. You can see it on a scope. You know right away from the waveform that it is. But phase modulation is, if I'm not mistaken, very similar to FM modulation in construction. So, for example, it's more of a constant. It's really hard for me to describe this. It's. For example, when you're looking at FM, it looks like a lot of white noise on a screen. Mm-hmm. phase modulation is kind of that same type of thing.
Well, I'm looking at it. There's an article in Wikipedia that describes amplitude modulation and phase modulation. It looks to me like phase modulation, the carrier frequency doesn't change, but it's sort of it looks like a bad heartbeat. It kind of skips a beat here and there. It doesn't go away, but you know, they'll have one cycle of the carrier wave, you know, extra long or extra short, which technically for that little short period of time, it is a different frequency. So I guess that's what's always confused me about the strict definition of phase modulation and frequency modulation. Phase modulation is not the frequency moving all over the place. Or within a set of parameters like frequency modulation, like FM is. But phase modulation, the frequency is always the same, except during those very short periods of time when it's moving or changing. Does that sound like a better description to you?
Yeah, it's similar a little bit, I guess, in theory, similar to what they used to do with AM stereo and that sort of thing. I kind of look at phase modulation as sort of that in between, you know, your basic AM and digital. You know, it's almost a way of encoding audio information.
Well, yeah, we can encode kind of a low bit rate, but we can encode information. We can phase modulate it, and that is right. That's how the AM stereo, back when that was somewhat a little bit popular, that there was L minus R information encoded in an analog form onto the carrier by phase modulating the AM carrier. So you can get some information to be modulated on there using phase modulation, but I don't think you could really send a heck of a lot of information in a phase modulated system. Should have looked it up beforehand, but there is information on that on Wikipedia, including lots of algebra and calculus.
Really?
Yeah.
Great. I'm going to save that for Friday night. That's when I do my math.
That's when you do your calculus. All right. Well, okay. Let's move on to the next one. Although it will be, I guess, a little bit interesting. People will come out, may come out with equipment that listens to the WWV and in its phase modulated sense, and we get better performance out of it. Maybe a solution looking for a problem, or who knows how widespread that'll be. But probably a good use of the technology that we know. I guess I'm kind of wondering.
We're engineers. That's what we do, is we create solutions for problems that don't yet exist.
Why didn't we do this 40 years ago? I mean, we could have.
Because we're so much smarter now.
Okay, well. All right. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal. Unfortunately, you have to be a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal to read the whole article. Otherwise, you just get enough to whet your interest. But in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, there's an article called "Dousing Lights to Save Birds. Deaths Could Be Avoided by Turning Off Steady Red Warning Signals on Towers."
Here we go.
Written by Robert Lee Hutz. And the article, at least the free part of the article, claims that every year about 6.8 million migrating birds die when they hit communications towers in the U.S. and Canada. All right, well, I'm going to take a little issue with their 6.8 million. That seems like a lot. But let's talk about what the article is talking about first. The notion here is that, and there have been certainly plenty of bird deaths at towers. It usually seems to come in waves. Okay, yeah, there'll be some low cloud cover, some difficult to navigate conditions for migratory birds to fly in. They come across through the mist, they see a red flashing light, a red flashing tower light, and they naturally head toward it, and they end up smacking the tower, falling to the ground, dying, getting injured, hitting guy wires. And it appears to be the slowly flashing red lights that attracts birds to the tower. And they really can't see the tower until they're just smack up against it.
See, that's again, when I'm done with the math, that's what I'm doing on Friday nights, is wandering into flashing red towers, stumbling around. This story comes up every couple of years. And obviously, I mean, there is something to this. There's enough smoke here where there's fire. I can tell you, I have five big, huge towers in my backyard. I've never seen a bird. I would see a random bird here or there, but I'm also in a wildlife area. So who's to say that was from a bird hitting the tower? And I always go back to this one story because it was real fascinating to me. The old, the tall tower out in Western Wisconsin in Eau Claire. And, there was a story one year printed in the paper that a lot of people point to, where there were these thousands of birds one morning as the town woke up, all of these birds dead around the tower site.
Yeah.
Well, somebody actually went and investigated that and tracked down people involved. And, when they got back down to it, nobody could really support that the thing that had ever happened. It was almost like an urban legend. So, I do think that there's something to it. I don't think it's – I guess in my experience, all the years that I've done this, I've never been to a site where that's been an issue. So, I do read it with interest, though. I mean, I do think there's something – there seems to be, a correlation, because, they're also saying that if you strobe it at night, it's a less of a hazard to the birds and that sort of thing. So I think there's something there. I just don't think that it's as widespread and as lethal as – people are making out to be.
On the web 6843, who might have access to the whole article, sorry, I haven't paid for the Wall Street Journal online, he says it's not just the flashing red lights, it's the constant red lights, and we know those as being called obstruction lights, whereas the flashing ones we call beacon lights. It may be the steady burning red lights that draw birds too, which of course will lead them straight to the tower as well. Okay, here's my couple of thoughts on this. I, for some years, was the engineer for a station with a tall tower in Frenchman's Bayou, Arkansas, and that was just a few miles, and by a few, I mean like 6 miles maybe, from the Mississippi River. Believe me, this was a migratory bird path, and I was all around that tower site. It was in the middle of a bean field, but we had equipment there, and we had a generator, and we had a road, and I'd go out to the guy anchor points to check them, and same as you. I never once saw a dead bird at this site. And if a bird was going to hit this, and by the way, it was a red lighted site for years. Later, they put a taller tower up there and strobe lit it. Now, supposedly strobe lights don't really invite the birds, you know, hey, come hit me. But the red lights do. But I never saw a dead bird there. And, you know, I'm not going to say I never saw a dead bird at any tower site I've been to, but I sure have been to hundreds of tower sites. And I don't recall ever saying, hey, there's some dead birds here. Not once, not ever. Now, I realize if they died and weren't found by a human, you know, pretty soon they're going to get, you know, picked up and taken away by who knows, feral cats out in the middle of nowhere, maybe not. But here's a question that was asked in the chat room. What about red lighted buildings? There are plenty of tall buildings in the U.S. on migratory bird paths that are red lighted, either with flashing lights or steady burning lights. Are there?
It kind of goes with the causation versus correlation type of thing. You know, The other thing that they never bring up in these studies is that where do you find radio towers most often? In the middle of nowhere, you know, in the country. So The chances of finding a dead bird out there are a whole lot greater than, for example, you know, a tall tower in the middle of a downtown area, where not only that, but you'd see a dead bird, you wouldn't think twice about it. So, you know, I do think that, you know, there is yet to be, I think, a really good, completely neutral point of view, blind controlled study on this. I think there's been a lot of conjecture, you know, both from the guys saying, it never happens, and the others who say, it happens all the time. You know, it's hard to say. It's kind of like saying, you know, I find flakes of paint at tower sites. So therefore, tower sites, you know, attract paint flakes. There's flaking paint on the tower. So of course you're going to find it there. You know, it's the same kind of thing.
When you climb a tower or are around the base of a tower site, there's a whole lot of bird poop there.
Well, that's so the other thing. I didn't invite them to come by. I mean, they could just leave if they'd like. I don't really have a problem with that.
Well, a couple other things, notes to add about this. Here in Nashville, where I live, there is a tower site. It belongs to WSMV Television, their Channel 4, the NBC affiliate. And for apparently some years, maybe some decades, and I wish I was really up on this, but for some decades, they have had a cooperative effort with a local chapter of the Audubon Society, and some volunteers go check the grounds frequently. I don't know if it's daily or weekly, but they check the grounds, and they've got a beautiful site. It's a tall tower. It's out on the west side of Nashville. They've got a nice site to walk around because that's where the studio is also. So they have plenty of acreage there, cut grass, parking lots. In other words, it's a good place to go find dead birds if there were some. And they do find some. But I think they've even had a couple of occasions where they found some, you know, quite a few dead birds here. I don't know if it was 10 or 20 or 100, but they have found dead birds there. Although it's not like they just wake up one morning and find 1,000 dead birds out there. So how you get to the figure of 6.8 million migrating birds die every year from towers? I just don't get that. I don't get where they sounds to me like somebody's looking for grant money.
I would show you where they get that number from, but I promised I wasn't going to drop trout this evening, so I can't tell you that. What I will say is the solution is we just simply need to pass a law saying it's illegal for birds to fly into towers.
There you go.
Problem solved.
There you go. So so one solution offered was turn off the tower lights. Now, before you say that's crazy and what about the planes, I do want to offer up a little point here. Imagine us, here we are 50 years in the future. We still have communication towers because we have to get radio signals projected from transmitted from a high point of view to have coverage. It's not so hard for every aircraft, including helicopters, flying to be GPS equipped. And GPS databases know where all the towers are. So would we get to a point where we don't need tower lights because any aircraft that might hit a tower has GPS in it. Not only does the plane not have to look out for a flashing light anymore, which, by the way, hasn't always been effective. Plenty of aircraft have run into towers with perfectly good working flashing lights. But the GPS is there, and just like a proximity warning to the ground or to rising terrain, the GPS navigation system in the aircraft could certainly warn you about, hey, you're in the proximity of a tower, and guess what, dude? You're 30 feet below the top of it, or you're only skimming 30 feet above the top of it. You know, warning, warning, Will Robinson. Danger, Will Robinson. So will we reach a point, Chris, chat room, where there's no need for tower lights?
It's interesting. I don't remember if this was at NAB or at one of the WBA conventions, but I actually talked to a guy who's participated in a test like that, where they had some towers that were keyed to which had sensors on them, along with airplanes that had sensors on them. And the way that these would work is the tower lights on the towers would stay off, and they wouldn't go on unless for some reason there was some concern that the airplane was getting close to the tower, and then the tower lights would come on to alert the pilot that the tower was there. And an antidote from the test was that a pilot went through and flew through the zone where these towers were, got back and complained that the stuff was broken. And he said, you know, tower lights never came on. And the guy said, yeah, because you were never close to hitting any of them. So I do think at some point, that's going to happen. I mean, I think it's just inevitable at some point that they've come up with some sort of system that's better than the typical flashing light system that we have now. Because you're right. I mean, nowadays with GPS and everything else, there's really not a whole lot of reason for it other than in cases of emergency. And I don't think it's too far out of away from the future where, you know, the tower light systems not only have the ambient light sensor for on and off, but also a perimeter sensor, where it can detect objects coming, you know, at an angle that maybe, you know, would interfere with the tower, and the lights would come on to signal that there's a problem. I think some point it's going to have to happen. I think that the tower light method is just an old, outdated technology.
Well, it's been brought up in the chat room from folks who either are pilots or know pilots or know about this, that see and avoid is the primary method of not hitting stuff if you're a flying VFR. It was brought up, well, what if the GPS database is wrong? Well, if the GPS database is wrong, there's a lot of other stuff that can go wrong. I mean, GPS is used every day for precision approaches to airports. I mean, that stuff's got to be right. Just like the towers have got to be right, which I know plenty of them are not right. And some of that's the fault of the tower owners that it's not right. But anybody can submit to the FCC or the FAA that the – see, I don't even know that the site, the data needs to be updated. Heck, in Cleveland, Mississippi, where I used to live, there was a county-owned tower that had been built and strobe lit. And the strobe lights were never worked right, and the tower was never on the database. And this is when I was flying, so I brought it up to the attention of, again, I forget, FCC or FAA, that both actually, come to think of it, that hey, here's a tower, and by the way, has no registration number. And the strobe lights aren't working properly, and it's not on the sectional chart. And somebody also brought up, well, hey, maybe it's on the GPS, but what about the guy wires? Well, the guy wires, you know, are in a cone below the top of the tower.
Yeah, if you're in the danger of hitting a guy wire, you're way too close to the tower.
Yeah, that's my thought too. And hey, red lights aren't on the guy wires anyway. So, it's not if you're flying along and there's red lights above you, well, guess what? There's a pretty darn good chance that you're going to hit a guy wire in whatever it is that you're doing. All right, Captain Bob in the chat room says, "Hey, I'm a pilot. You don't think you need lights on a tower? When you drive home, don't turn on the headlights in your car." Wow, that's completely different. That's just not analogous. But I understand what you're saying. I mean, if you're a VFR pilot and you're used to looking out for tower lights, I get it. I mean, you don't want to not know it's there. But do you think we'll have tower lights in 50 years from now?
Well, the better analogy with the car lights would be, sure, okay, if the car was always parked on the corner of First and Main.
Yeah,
the car's there, whether or not the lights are on.
Or a perfectly good analogy would be, well, what if your front porch light was burned out? Would you still get to your house?
Yeah. I mean, there are key safety concerns right now. Absolutely. I am not saying that we need to turn off tower lights today. I am saying that I do predict in the future that will change. And, it may not change everywhere. It may change. I think where you'll see a change are, maybe urban areas where tower lights aren't nearly as important as, you would find a 1,500-foot tower in the middle of nowhere. For example, I mean, I've got, five 450-foot towers in an urban area. you know, the chances that a plane's going to be flying that low are almost zero. And you could almost get away with lighting one tower as closely spaced as my antennas are. You know, I get away with lighting one tower and be okay. So, you know, there are kind of these things where I think right now it's a little over the top, especially with AM arrays, with the amount of lighting required. And I just think that, you know, at some point there'll be some modifications to that.
Well, Captain Bob, actually, I am a pilot, and I've flown past plenty of towers. And no, I'm not. I wouldn't be excited about not lighting towers. But at some point in the future, tell you what, we won't go there. But I just think that it's something that might happen down the road. There's plenty of other things that we avoid nowadays with GPS, and towers might be something else. All right. So the two ideas offered were turn the tower lights off or switch to strobe lighting, which is apparently not as attractive to birds. I can tell you strobe lighting is a lot more expensive to purchase. It may be cheaper to operate in terms of electricity, but overall maintenance over the years, it's probably a wash or more expensive. I'm sure the strobe light guys would tell you otherwise, and the red light guys would tell you that theirs is better. There's also the red lighting that's now produced by LEDs, which is, you know, certainly saves a lot of electricity, lasts a lot longer than incandescent bulbs. And probably my guess is that LED lighting is probably overall more reliable than strobe lighting. Chris, do you have a guess about that?
I absolutely do, actually. Several years ago, probably going on 5 years now, I replaced all of the incandescent lights on my five tower array with LEDs. And that's, we're talking about something in the order of 20 obstructions and 20 beacons, I believe, in this site. Now, obviously, our power consumption went way down. Honest to God, in the middle of the night, if the generator was on, you could hear the generator load change as the tower lights flashed. Generator would go, as it tried to power all the beacons. You know, so you have that, and, you know, they would burn out, and I would literally be replacing, I'd have the climbers out at least once a month replacing a bulb. I mean, that's 40 different bulbs going at any given moment, and there's always one burning out. So I replaced them to LEDs. Our power consumption was cut by almost 90%, and we've not had a single failure in 5 years. And they're brighter and on the right angles. They're brighter where they should be brighter than the old incandescents. For example, the way that the lenses are made, they're not real bright if you're on the ground looking at it, like in the neighborhood. But you go about 10 miles out of town. I've been 35 miles out of town, and I can see my array because of the, you know, we're higher up in the air than the towers are. So yeah, we're right at that angle where we can see into the tower array, and they are extremely bright. So LEDs are fantastic. Now, on the other hand, I have worked with sites with strobes. Now, they do have new LED strobes that are a little more reliable. But
really?
I have not been to a site that has strobes where the guy hasn't said, I really wish I didn't have strobes. The controllers, yeah. Unfortunately, they use electronic controllers. And what happens is just the lightning just kills them every time. And I don't know how many times I've driven by a site after a storm with a tower that's strobed, and the strobes are either in day mode or they're not working at all, or half of them are out. And it requires a tower guy to climb up there. Not only that, but a tower guy, if you want to get it done cheaply, the tower guy's got to know electrical, because otherwise you're taking that controller box off of the tower and bringing it down with you. And then you're talking about a whole lot of money. So that's not anecdotally. That's just talking to people who, you know, actually work with the stuff that, you know, I can tell you I have not even thought about my controller system other than doing tests on it in years. It just works. And so I have nothing but good things to say about that. Strobes, on the other hand, are kind of problematic.
Zach in the chat room asks, can't they just attach some bird repelling device to the guy wires and maybe keep the birds away that way? And I've actually heard of something like that working. It's a few years ago, but somebody developed something that they were trying. So you attach it to the guy wire and it flutters or makes a noise or something in the breeze and discourages birds from coming nearby. You hear anything about that?
No, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things you could do. I don't think, you know, again, I don't think it's a big enough problem. But real quickly on the LEDs too, one of the things, the first generation LEDs got a pretty bad rap, and especially on AM towers. And they were pretty new technology. And, you know, obviously they work completely differently compared to conventional incandescents. But they have come such a long way, and I have them on, again, an AM array, and I've never had a problem. But, you know, there were a lot of premature failures in the early years. And I think the thing about LED fixtures is generally if they're going to die, they die pretty early on. But once you get past that, you know, one and a half year mark, after that, they just, you know, they just go and go.
Here's your solution. Giant stuffed cats attached to the tower.
Love it. That's what we're going to do. Instead of flashing strobes, we'll have flashing cats.
Flashing cats. You know, it is amazing how far you can see a light that's bright and you're not obstructed by obviously trees or terrain or much in the atmosphere. And it reminds me of some years ago when I lived in Mississippi. I lived just a couple of miles away from a tall television tower. And the strobe lights on it, the controller, I swear, this is the failure mode I see all across the country, daytime strobes at night.
I had one flashing in my bedroom window a couple of years ago.
Drives me nuts because the daytime strobes are one single pulse. They're a flash. Whereas nighttime strobes typically are a burst of where it's enough time for your eye to go move to where the strobes are. Remember, you can't see the structure because it's dark. You can just see the light. So your eye has to move and see where the structure is. If you have daytime strobes, just a pulse at night, and it's really dark, you can't see the structure, your eye cannot actually find the structure. You will see a flash and your eye will move to it, and typically your eye will go past it. And then you'll see a strobe again, and you'll go this way. And look, I'm a reasonably intelligent guy. I have a decent vision. One time, I pulled off the side of the road, and I tried my darndest to look at a tower just about a mile away that had day strobes at night, and it looked like a UFO moving around because my eye could not lock onto it, and I had no other nearby visual references to lock on either.
I just imagined as I looked out the window the one night when I had the one, my old house, like I would have this sunburn except for where the windowsill was on my face, just from the boom, the flash in my face. It was unbelievable. And I knew the engineer who stationed it was. And I finally, next morning I called him and I said, next time leave me the keys and I will go and fix it myself when this happens. Cause I was up all night with a thing flashing in my window.
To come to think of it, my house in Mississippi, it would light up the side of the house, not to the point where I couldn't sleep. But if you went outside at night, and I lived out in the boonies, you could stand by the house at night and see the whole side of the house just light up every time that thing would go off. Well, and that tower was a couple miles away. Well, one night I was flying on a commercial flight, long story, but I had to fly from Memphis to Jackson, Mississippi to get a cheap ticket and then, you know, get off the plane in Jackson, Mississippi, and drive all the way back to Cleveland, Mississippi. Yeah, I wanted to just get out of the plane right over my house because we flew almost right over it. But I was in a window seat, and I could look down there, and this tower operating, again, tall television tower, operating with day strobes at night, I could clearly see it from, I think we were at 17,000 feet. I could clearly see that tower from 17,000 feet. Now, of course, the tower was 1,000 feet tall, so, okay, I was only 16,000 feet away from it. But that's just how far away you can see a strobe light. I really couldn't see. I don't recall being able to see any of the red lighted towers. But again, this was day strobes at night. Hey, we're gonna get to a couple of Chris Tarr's favorite subjects here. Right after our break, we want to hear from our sponsor, and the sponsor of today's show is my employer and my friends at Axia Audio. And there is a special deal coming up for you. Do you need an audio console? Would you like to be able to get an audio console for like under $6,000 list price? This is the Axia Radius console. And hey, Burke, if you've got that picture, you might want to bring it up here. If you need a console, you can get the Axia Radius console. List price is under $6,000. Price may vary in your part of the world. But this is a fully live wire connected audio console. It's got a built-in Ethernet switch. It's got built-in. There it is. Right there at the Twit Network, that's Leo's personal Radius console that he uses. And with just a single slim Ethernet connector, it's totally connected to the rest of the Livewire network there at the Twit Network. We're running a special at Telos. You can find out about it from your dealer. They've just gotten word about it, that if you get a Radius console, Telos is going to buy you an analog telephone hybrid, and a Telos HX1 telephone hybrid, which you can just plug right up to your Radius console. If you haven't been able to take phone calls, if you need a new console for your production room and you'd like to be able to play spots down the phone line or interview people, we're going to throw in an HX1 telephone hybrid. And this special is good all around the world. Doesn't matter what country you're in. Your dealer is either aware of it or just now being made aware of it. And, hey, if you're listening on the Twit Network, you are one of the first to know here about this special. So the special is good through, I believe, just about the end of September. So you've got a couple of months. But if you're interested in getting a free Telos HX1 phone hybrid, you can get one. Just pick up a Radius audio console and you'll have it. I'm installing two Radius audio consoles this summer. In fact, in August, in American Samoa, in Pongo Pongo, American Samoa. So I'll be having fun doing that. And I don't know if I get a free HX1 or not. I think the company's already given me a pretty good deal on the console. Check it out on the web, axiaaudio.com. And the word of the special is not on the website yet, but your dealer will have word of it by tomorrow morning. All right. AxiaAudio.com. Thanks to them for sponsoring this edition of This Week in Radio Tech. Chris, you're not getting any Radius consoles, are you?
No, I'm looking at the big boys.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we don't give nothing free with the big boys.
No, that's true. I know that.
We just charge you a lot of money.
There you go.
Okay, so Chris, your project, you're building new studios. What's going on with you?
And actually, before I get into that, because it's interesting, but it's kind of dry. There is something that I think the geeks here, and I say that affectionately because I am one. I am the geek Jedi. something the geeks here would appreciate. One of the jobs that I do is I do consulting engineering, contract engineering for stations all over the place, generally smaller stations that can't afford a full-time engineer. Well, one of the projects I was working on is for a small AM radio station that uses an equalized line, which is just basically a special phone line from the telephone company that allows us to broadcast or to send audio from the studio to the transmitter through this special phone line. Well, it's old and it's beat up and the phone company doesn't like it. You know, they don't like selling them because they're kind of difficult to maintain. And so this particular audio line sounded pretty bad and had a hard time working a lot of times. You know, we get pretty noisy or it would drop out completely, something like that. So we're looking for a way to do this. Now, I couldn't put up your typical microwave link just because it's in where the studio was and where the transmitter was. We couldn't get a clear shot, so we were unable to do the conventional microwave link. So we also they couldn't afford a T1 for a high powered business class line. So after using an IP codec for a while successfully at my stations here, I said, well, why don't we do that? You know, why don't we look at doing something over IP? So we had DSL put out at the transmitter site, cable modem at the studio, and we set up something to send audio over IP. And what we've done is put in a silent sensor, so if the IP connection drops, the DSL disconnects or something like that, it flips over to the old noisy circuit. But the audio is so much better. Well, the geek story, here's the geek story. This is just the setup. I was down there 2 weeks ago to install the equipment. Well, it turns out that there was a problem with the DSL line at the transmitter site, and it wasn't working right. But I was there, and I needed to get it wired up and the silent sensor tested and that sort of thing. So how do I get these codecs to talk to each other? Studio side, I had set up. It was working fine. Couldn't get anything. We were dead in the water at the transmitter site. So I pull out my 3G Samsung tablet. I turn on Wi-Fi sharing for the network.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So I've got that going. So I've got a Wi-Fi hotspot. I open up my Mac. I connect to the Wi-Fi hotspot, which sees the internet. Yeah. I turn on internet sharing on the Mac, which shares the internet connection over the Ethernet jack. And I plug the Ethernet jack, using the Ethernet jack, a cord from the computer to the codec. And guess what? It worked fantastically. I had it running for about an hour using that connection. So sitting over here in the corner is my Wi-Fi tablet with the 3G connection there, my computer talking to it over Wi-Fi, then, sharing that internet connection with the codec. And I had it up and running. Audio was playing almost an hour. In fact, it was kind of sad when I had to turn it off because it was working.
Because the DSL started working?
No, I actually didn't start working, but I had to leave. So I had to
put it back on the,
I had to take my tablet and go home. But, you know, talk about the Swiss Army knife and you know, kind of doing the Geek Jedi thing. It was fantastic. I just had a lot of fun doing that. So that, that was just,
and when you get that work, that makes you feel so proud. I've actually done something similar with a Wi-Fi hotspot on this phone to the Wi-Fi stick on a Telos Zip 1 and streamed just fine for hours using that method. And, of course, also done that with a Cradle Point. Cradle Point getting 3G or 4G and then turning that into Wi-Fi or a wired. The Cradle Point I have will do either one. And running a Telosip one that way. But I'm, yeah, obviously it works with other codecs too.
It was great just, you know, calling the owner going, hey, you hear your radio station? Yeah, that's on because it's streaming through my little tablet on the cell mount. So enough about that story. We're up to now where the building project in Milwaukee is well underway. And it's been a lot of fun. We haven't actually gotten to do any of the good building stuff yet. That's still to come. But we have to do a lot of grading and a lot of earth moving to get this done. And it's been a lot of fun. But my particular project today, which was kind of funny, was, you know, it's one of those things where no good deed goes unpunished. So essentially, I'm kind of left on my own on this project, which is already, you know, lots of fun because there's no pressure there. But we got the grading in the front done. And as part of this, we're having to grade the front of the building and the back of the building. And we have a lot of trees there, a lot of mature trees on the lot. Most of them had to be torn out. We have these four really nice crabapple trees up the walkway in front of the building. And I just hated to see them go. And I said, well, why don't we, since we've got to tear out everything on the other side of the building that faces the street, why don't we move the trees? We'll take the trees from next to the sidewalk. We'll pull them out. They're mature, really nice trees. We'll move them and transplant them to the front of the building. And it'll save us some money in buying trees and things like that. And great. Let's do it. That's fantastic. So we fast forward to today, and nobody has decided where these trees are going to go. So all day I'm dealing with the contractors. Where do you want these trees? Like, what do I know about trees? I don't care where you put them. Put them in the ground somewhere. You know, it's just been my entire day, you know, trying to fix, you know, engineering things. And it's been, I've had to be this arborist. It's like, I don't care where the trees go. Put them in the ground. Make sure they grow. That's what I care about. So, you know, it's those sorts of things. You know, and then tomorrow, for example, I'm going to be directing traffic because we have to close off our parking lot for the day while they do some work. So what we were going to do was, you know, I was trying to figure out how we're going to manage all these cars and parking. And so we're going to park them on the lawn in front of the building.
Okay.
So, you know, I was thinking, okay, how can I do this? You know, my first inclination was I wanted to bring some lawn chairs and some beer and just watch everybody try to park. That was the original plan.
Entertainment.
Unfortunately, you know, it turned into Carmageddon. I wanted to like arm the cars with missiles,
Carmageddon,
and spikes, and just let them all have it and figure the last one standing gets the spot closest to the building. But instead, what I'm going to do tomorrow is I'm going to be donning the vest. I'm going to be directing traffic in the morning to make sure people get parked. But I'll tell you, you know, in all seriousness, the one interesting thing about this, I don't know if it's one interesting thing, but, you know, what fascinates me is all the things that I didn't know that I didn't know about building and grading and all these kinds of things. It's really it's fascinating. It's a whole new kind of an experience for me, which is good and bad. There's a lot of stress in putting something like this together, but it really is fascinating to see it come along and see all the changes that have been made. But you really do have to, for the first time, and that's hard for a lot of engineers to do because we all think we know everything. I mean, I don't think I know everything, but, you know, you really kind of have to trust the craftsmen that are involved in these different trades and, you know, say, listen, I got to be honest with you. I have no idea how you're supposed to get this done. So you tell me, you know, what you need from me to make this happen. And, you know, there's a whole lot of having to just admit that you don't know what you're doing, you know, and you really are kind of relying on them to get it done. And I do have a general contractor, but there's a, you know, I'm handling a lot of the kind of the day-to-day stuff at the radio station. So it's been interesting. And I'll look in a little bit here for some links to some of the pictures that I have of the work. I posted them on, I have a Flickr or not Flickr, a Picasa stream going of some of the pictures of all the earth moving and things. And there have been a lot of changes. So Yeah, so I'm pretty tired. It's a lot of work.
I'm loving the chat. I'm loving the chat room, telling you, talking about get me a shrubbery.
That's right. I'm just like, yeah, you do your tree thing, guy. That's awesome.
Hey, Chris, can somebody shoot some video of you in an orange vest directing traffic?
No.
Oh, come on.
And if anybody has it, I will deny that it ever happened.
Oh, and the white gloves and the moving around and the get out in the street there.
How about no?
Oh, man, that would be great. Well, if you can show us Valentine underwear, surely we can see you in an orange vest.
Be great for you guys. Let's see. I'm getting the link here for the.
Oh, and a whistle in your mouth. Yep. Need that.
Tweet. God's sakes. My engineer from Madison, Tony's coming up to help. I'm going to watch him do it. I'm just going to sit.
Okay, there you go.
I'm going to supervise because that's what I do well.
But I need video. Need video for the next tort. We want to see it. Hey, did you post sometime in the last few days that they had torn up accidentally something, some conduit or something?
Yeah.
What was that about?
By the way, I just posted that in the chat room. I just posted the link to those pictures.
Okay.
Yes. There, as a matter of fact, wait a second. My video froze. Can you guys still hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Well, I'll continue then. I had just, oh my goodness. You had to bring that up. It's like tearing me up. We're having fiber optics installed into the building, faster internet speed.
Yeah.
And so what we had to have conduit put down into the ground to run the fiber. That's what AT&T requires. And, so that's what I had to do. So what I ended up doing was I had the electrical company come out and run this conduit in the front of the building. Just, 2 feet down. It was great. It was perfect. There was one end right on the side, right in the right of way where they needed to connect. And we put a box with a pull rope into the building. All set. Fibers, Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Literally, the guy hadn't even left the site. Uh-huh. Literally 2 hours after they had just covered up the trench, the GC comes by with the paperwork and went, oh, we need to do some grading out here. And we're going to have to go about 2.5 feet down.
Oh,
I just paid $3,000 to have the trench put in.
Oh,
so at that point, my hair started to fall out in clumps and I got a little nervous tick. Okay, fine. Well, all right. We'll work around it. The grading guy says, oh, don't sweat it. We will, we know it's there. We'll try to work around it. We may damage a little piece of it by rolling over it or something. But, don't worry about it. Well, we're good. Okay, so I'm watching, I believe it was yesterday, as they were doing the grading in the front, and all of a sudden, I see big chunks of PVC pipe getting yanked out of the ground and flying through the air. And I look out, and they get done, and I look out into the yard, and just shiny, glistening little pieces of gray PVC scattered about the front. Oh. And I just, it's like, oh, my God. Goodness. So, the one of the worst parts about it is, as you know, dealing with the phone company, if I were to call the phone company and say, hey, listen, the conduit got tore up, we're replacing it, they'll put in a stop order and you're going to be waiting another 2 weeks. So I'm like, do not tell anybody that this happened. And I actually got the company to come back out early this morning. They tore it out yesterday afternoon, early this morning to retrench and put in a new piece section where the other section was torn out. And, so the story ended well. Fortunately, there's no fiber in the trench or in the conduit yet.
Oh, they hadn't put it. Oh, okay.
But the problem was that they're going to, and if they had caught wind that the PVC pipe got the conduit got pulled out, they would have put a stop order on something that we've been waiting 2 months to have done. I mean, you know how it is, it's all paperwork and, the minute something changes on your end, they stop work until until it gets fixed and they start it again. So if I had told them that the conduit was gone, it would have been another couple of weeks.
I thought you were going to tell me though that the fiber was already in it and that you just got the ends and twisted them together.
That was the silver lining to the cloud. What was just killing me was I had just put the conduit in, and literally 3 hours later, they're like, oh, yeah, that's going to be a problem. It's like, where were you yesterday? I'm telling you.
Chris,
and
good story.
Cool Breeze, oh, my goodness, were not the polite words that I used.
Oh, my goodness. And on that note, we got to go. We have filled up our hour. There's pictures from the site.
In fact, you can see, that's where the trucks are. That's new portion of the parking lot. So we got that going. Got a new parking lot going, and that's kind of cool. I'm trying to put, if you guys, those who are interested in following along, save that link, because as time goes on, that's where I'm putting the pictures, at least for the first phase of the construction. And so we'll have some more pictures. We'll actually have some pictures tomorrow once we get the trees moved.
All right. I'll be looking forward to it. Keeps up to date. And get that video camera out on Tony with the whistle and the gloves and the vest.
Oh, yeah. Well, somebody, one of the sales account executives came up to me and said, so are you going to valet park the car too? And I said, yeah, right over to the retention pond.
Oh, gee. All right. Webb in the chat room says you can't twist fiber together. You have to solder it.
Oh, see, that's what I was doing wrong. I was actually, I put XLRs on each end and tried to put them together that way.
We got to go. Thanks for your time, Chris. I appreciate you being here tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, glad to be had anytime. And your website that you will that people should go to learn about broadcast engineering?
Absolutely. Stop by broadcastengineering.info. You can also follow me on Twitter with @TheGeekJedi.
All right. Good deal. And you, if you're interested, if you like this show, you can see it on the twit.tv website, twit.tv/twert. And from the from each episode page, you can watch it there. You can download it. You can get the audio or the video, and you can subscribe to this podcast. And we would sure appreciate it if you would just go ahead and subscribe to it. That way it'll be downloaded automatically to your whatever you use, iTunes or something else. It'll get there automatically. We'd appreciate that. Hey, thanks very much to our sponsor, Axia Audio, running a special. You buy a Radius console, you get a free Telos HX1 digital hybrid for POTS phone lines. Thanks very much, Axia. And thanks to Burke at the Twit Network for producing our show. Really appreciate you, Burke, very much. Thanks for being there. Also, I think Jammer V was around there, too. Thank you all very much. We're going to see you guys next week on This Week in Radio Tech. And we got lots of great guests coming up in the next few weeks. So we hope we'll see you then. Next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.